Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
And welcome to Stage Door Johnny, the podcast about theatre and life in the theatre. My name's Jonathan Cake, and I have some kind of man flu, but it's England, it's January, it's practically compulsory to have some kind of airborne filth. So here I am. But I am extremely cheered by the episode that I have for you today. I'm going to say that this episode contains more great stories about the theatre per square foot than perhaps any other episode I've done before. It features a chat with two brilliant actors who just happen to be married to each other. The power couple that is Emily Mortimer and Alessandro Nivola. And to make things even more piquant, it was recorded in front of a live audience at German Street Theatre just before Christmas last year, 2023, and Em and Sandro put on the most fantastic show for the lucky audience. So Alessandro, if you don't know his credits, and you should, won the Screen Actors Guild Award, the British Independent Film Award, for his performance in Disobedience, a brilliant film if you haven't seen it. He was in Jurassic Park. He was in Face Off with John Travolta and Nicolas Cage. He was in American Hustle with his then co-star in The Elephant Man on stage on Broadway and in the West End, Bradley Cooper, who gets a lot of coverage in our upcoming conversation, for which Sandro was nominated for the Tony Award for his performance in The Elephant Man. His list of collaborators in, what is it now, almost 30 years of making movies is like a who's who of American cinema. He's about to play a rhinoceros for Marvel, for goodness sake. He's just one of America's best actors. Emily is an Independent Spirit-winning film actress for Lovely and Amazing. Lovely and Amazing. Do you remember Emily and Lovely and Amazing? That's bravery. If you don't know what I'm talking about, it's brave and amazing. She's worked with Martin Scorsese twice. Come on. She is in cultural juggernauts like Mary Poppins, and she's in the upcoming Paddington 3. She's also the writer, director, producer, star of Doll and M, also featuring a young ingenue called Jonathan Cake. And she is the director and adapter of Nancy Mitford's Pursuit of Love. She is the writer of an upcoming Noah Baumbach movie starring George Clooney. I mean, she's a powerhouse, Emily. They are just an extraordinary couple. So I'm going to transport you now to the beautifully intimate surroundings of the German Street Theatre in the heart of London's glittering West End, just before Christmas, a chilly night. Oh, thank you, Stella, Paul Jones, and your amazing team at German Street. Thank you so much for hosting us. There'll be more. I can't wait. All right, here's Emily Mortimer and Alessandro Nivola.
Ladies and gentlemen of the Stage Door Johnny Company, this is your beginner's call. Mr. Cake, Mr. Nivola, and Ms. Mortimer to the stage, please. This is your beginners.
Do you mind me sitting in between you?
No, need you to sit between.
It's like an episode of Mr. and Mrs.
Yeah.
Where we find out how much you know about each other. Yes. You are married.
Yes.
Good.
I believe so.
Just checking. Very strong morals policy on this podcast. And you didn't meet on stage, but you did meet doing Shakespeare.
It was a Shakespeare musical, so it may as well have been on stage.
Right.
It was Ken Branagh's film of Love's Labour's Lost. And do you think that that particular environment, that charge, the charged verse, the songs, Nathan Lane, do you think that was helpful in your courtship? Did it have anything to do with it?
What it had to do with it was that I was living in LA at the time, and my next door neighbor was Leonard Cohen's son, who is a guy named Adam Cohen.
Oh, yeah.
Also a musician, and he was in a band that was touring around Europe, and he had just come back to LA when I got this gig to go and be in Love's Labour's Lost, and I told him that I was going over there, and he called me over to his apartment and said that he had something for me to give me, and he dug in his drawers, and he took out all these like little bits of paper clips and lint, and there was a little rolled up piece of paper with a phone number on it. And he put it in my hand and he said, "This is the number of the hottest girl in London." And I was like, "Okay, you know," and he said, "Take it with you, call her when you get there." And I said, "Well, how did you meet her?" And he said, he was at an audition for Moulin Rouge, the film, the Baz Luhrmann movie. And they were calling in musicians and singers and stuff to play the Ewan McGregor part because they hadn't figured out how they were going to cast that. And in the waiting room, he'd been sitting there and there was this beautiful girl there that he struck up a conversation with. He told her that he was doing a gig that night and he got her number and said, I'll call you and see if you want to come to the show. And she said, okay. And he called her, and she never returned his call. Oh. But he had the number, and he gave it to me. So I flew over, you know, like I thought it was the stupidest thing. Like, I'm going to call this girl and say my friend, my next-door neighbor in L.A. got your number at an audition for Moulin Rouge. You didn't call him back, but maybe you'll call me back. And I showed up at the Athenaeum here in Piccadilly, and I unpacked my stuff, and there was like a packet of information that had stuff about the movie, and I was brushing my teeth and I was going down the cast list, and this name looked familiar, and I emptied my pockets and I took out the little piece of paper.
I wish people who will listen to this on the podcast could see the acting.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Everyone's noticing the detail, the physical detail. Don't stop.
I know how to use my hands.
You sure do. I'm with you on the teeth and the thing. Oh, wait, do I still have that? Am I wearing the same trousers that I put the piece of paper with her number in?
I haven't even done the accent.
That's really good.
And so I unrolled the paper and she was in the movie. And so
we have like one line in the movie.
Well, we don't know it's you yet.
Sorry.
No, you're right, we don't.
And I showed up the first day to rehearsal, and the rehearsals, it was like the, you know, Fame, the kids from Fame or whatever, like the way that he had organized the rehearsals. We were filming at Shepperton, and it was like rehearsing for a play because he designed this production like a Busby Barkley musical. Yeah. And we had to learn all these, Cole Porter and Irving Berlin songs and all this dancing and everything. So there were 2 weeks of rehearsals and we had our like little tap shoes on and our backpacks and we would go from room to these different rehearsals. And so the first day I walked in and with my little knapsack on and I said, you know, which one's Emily Mortimer?
Surely you would have known.
And they pointed me over to her. And
there she is.
And he was dead right. And I went up to her and I said, "I have your phone number." And
direct,
and
bold.
And she was like a little taken aback.
Creeped out.
And
no,
I explained
that was the American way, maybe.
Sure it was.
Yeah, brash, direct.
It. Got it.
And sure enough, you know, he was right. And 2 weeks later, I invited her out. And she couldn't go, and she invited me instead to go to this Russian wedding that she had to go to.
No, you invited me. You called me and said, "Do you want to go to the movies?" And I was like, "Yes." And I can remember thinking, "Oh, God." Because I thought you found me irritating because I was always on my mobile phone.
That's true.
And I kept saying to my mom, "There's this American guy that really hates me because he's always complaining that I'm on my phone." And she said, "That's the one you like." And I was like, "No, I don't. He's sort of just annoying and annoyed by me." But then he called me up and asked me out to the movies. And I can remember this feeling of excitement as he called. And I said, yes, I'd love to come. And then I put the phone in, and then I remembered I was going to a Russian wedding where I was doing a reading. I couldn't go to the movies, so I had to ring him back and say, I can't come. I'm so sorry. I'm doing a reading at a Russian wedding. And he said, well, why don't I come too? And it was Valentine's Day, the day of the Russian wedding. And he was so bold. And we went out for lunch. And then we went to this Russian wedding in a Russian church. And he held my hand.
Oh, God.
On Valentine's Day.
Sorry, don't let me stop you. This is amazing. Keep going. This is written by Richard Curtis.
Anyway, I ended up bringing her home to Adam Cohen. Oh. That's long story short. And I was like,
powerful image.
You told me to bring her home.
Got it. So Cole Porter and a Shakespeare comedy really had nothing to do with it. It could have been a film by Gary Oldman. Could be Nil by Mouth, and you would.
Yes, it wasn't very romantic, and actually the end product wasn't. It is really sweet, but it wasn't that good. It was in People magazine of the year two, as one of the worst films of the year 2000.
I often think that people are more bonded by the disasters artistically.
It was sort of ambitious and sweet. It was a like beautiful, glorious
failure. I love how she
failure.
Says that and she's like, I only had three lines and I was the lead role.
No, it was adorable.
But wait, on-set romances or backstage romances are a very common thing in our business. Do you think there's a reason why?
You might have had something.
Well, I don't want to say the person
start
who
that way.
The
too.
Person who whooped when we said welcome to Stage Door Johnny Live. It's true. We did meet on a TV set for a show called Marriage. Hilariously, life imitated bad art. But I'm just curious about why you think this is, and I suppose I've got a theory behind it.
Yes.
Tell me what you think of this theory. That, and this applies, of course, to not just sort of falling in love or romances when you're acting with somebody. The body doesn't know that the brain is lying. Just let that sink in for a minute. What do you think of that? The body doesn't know that the brain is lying. The brain, neurologically...
The brain doesn't know what to make
but
of
no,
this
but,
statement.
No, I know. I know what you're saying. You're saying when you pretend to fall in love with someone, you kind of do a little bit. Or if you're pretending to hate someone, maybe you do a little
bit. Yes, because as actors, I think we don't really talk about this enough, that actors, of course, you know, famously get a bad rap for sort of being self-absorbed and narcissistic and all those things, which are sometimes reasonable accusations. But there is another side of it, which is actually, I think, neurological and physical, which is that we go into this state where you are telling yourself to feel something and then sort of blaming your body for feeling it. You know, I've done plays on stage where I played Antony Cleopatra, a poor guy tries to kill himself, botches the job, and spends the rest of the sort of 20 minutes stage time bleeding out, like the Tim Roth character in Reservoir Dogs. And of course, every night I came off from that, and my neck and shoulder and my back were crippled. And I suppose afterwards I thought, well, what was I expecting, really? How can you send your body the signals that you are committing to this idea without having physical pain? And the same is true, I think, for our hearts or any other part of us when we are, you know, falling in love, pretending to fall in love. It's a very potent mixture of dopamine we're sending around the body. Does this sound like bullshit to
no,
you?
No, no, I totally, I think you're completely right. The only thing in our instance is that I was pretending to fall in love with Adrian Lester and he was pretending to fall in love with Alicia Silverstone, and we didn't fall in love with either of those people, but we fell in love with each other. Mm. Or they didn't fall in love with us. Maybe that was more the problem. Because I can... But anyway, no, but I think you're right. I mean, I definitely think that you go... Yes, you go through something physically that sort of is very similar to the thing that you're pretending to go through, and then that can be, and also, but the other thing about falling in love with somebody in a movie, or haven't done it really in a play. We were married in a...
I think we were having an affair.
We're having an affair.
Sure.
We were having an affair.
We've done a play together. We'll get to that.
Yes. but it was already a bit toxic and weird, wasn't it? It wasn't like we fell in love.
Well, I think between us.
No. But anyway, but what I mean is that falling in love or pretending to fall in love is actually quite embarrassing in a movie or a play, I have found. I mean, in movies more than plays, as I said. And so you're bonded together by the sort of ridiculousness of it, especially doing love scenes, where it becomes incredibly sort of intense and sort of earnest. And everybody gets very serious and sort of looks at the floor and gets these sort of weird, hushed voices, like It's more like a funeral than a sort of love scene. And everybody's sort of very respectful and talking in these hushed tones. And the director's saying, now move her hair from her face and touch her breast or whatever. And it's just like the least sexy thing ever. And you're kind of just bonded. You kind of fall in love with the other person because you're just both in such excruciating misery. And it's so embarrassing. And everybody's handing you sort of bathrobes and sort of telling you to sort of, I don't know, sort of feeling sorry for you.
Right.
And then it's just ridiculous and funny and you're in it together. And then you come out of this day just feeling like you've been through some horrendous experience together. And I think that maybe is more, well, in my experience, that sort of bonding. But,
yeah.
But I do know what you mean. I mean, do you feel that, Sandra, that when you act something, you kind of, your body feels it?
The idea that the mind, the body doesn't know the mind is lying, but that acting is a form of lying, and we communicate these very strong thoughts to our bodies, and the bodies think it's the real thing.
This is all too intellectual for me. I just, like, the relief of acting for me is that I don't think about it in those terms.
Got it. Let's do this then instead. Do you remember when you were first on stage?
Vaguely, yeah. I was very, very young. I was in a furry outfit in a school play. The first few roles that I had were I was in furry outfits to the point where I started thinking at one point that maybe I had misinterpreted the signals of what my career was path was supposed to be, and that instead I was supposed to be a furry.
An animal.
You know, those people who dress up and go around with, like, tails and things. And, like, put implant whiskers on their faces. rather than acting.
Well, it's still time. Which furry animal stands out most?
Well, there were two formative ones. This is so lame. The first one was a hedgehog.
Oh, good.
In a Winnie the Pooh play.
Not furry, prickly.
Well, no, mine was furry. They didn't. that was beyond my mother's
duality
pay grade
of the hedgehog
to sew in the actual quills.
Your mother made the costume?
Yes. Oh, yeah. That's all my fun costumes for years.
Amazing.
Yeah.
I wonder where they are.
Yeah, me too. Anyway, I just had to pull a poo out of a hole with, like, a bunch of other, like, I was at the end of a line of of other furry animals. I just had to, like, come on. I came on for 10 seconds. I just pulled, and out he came, and then off I went. That was it. And then the second one was Toto in The Wizard of Oz.
Oh, that's a good part.
It was a part I had auditioned for the Cowardly Lion, and I didn't get it.
Oh.
And but they gave me Toto, and
no lines.
Really, like, turned it to my advantage. I thought that psychologically it was a win. I came home and told my parents that I didn't have any lines, but I was in every scene. And
scene stealing,
yeah,
a dog on stage.
I don't think I stole much, but I was there.
Do you remember your first time on stage?
Yes, I was Mustard Seed in a Midsummer.
Now you see this. I think we're seeing the difference between the classy and the... This is why Adam Cohen was like, you know, you want to find out what Emily Mortimer's up to. Mustard Seed in Midsummer Night's Dream,
yes,
as opposed to a hedgehog.
Yes, got it. But I didn't, I mean, does Mustard Seed even have any lines? Maybe one or two.
Mm.
At Kensington High School for Girls.
Very good.
Yes.
Do you remember being excited? Was it a
I do remember
thing?
Feeling really excited that I was chosen to be Mustard Seed and feeling sort of amazed. But I was really young. I was probably only about 8 or something. So it wasn't yet the terrifying thing that theatre became. And I experienced, my first proper performance was when I was about 14 and I joined the speaking competition, school speaking competition, which was so strange because I was the really shyest, the most sort of freakishly shy person where I literally couldn't put my hands up in class without going puce red. And I never wanted anyone to come to my house or go to anybody else's house. And I was just in a constant state of sort of mortification and embarrassment and shyness. And I don't know why. Actually, we were talking about this earlier today with your kids, the feeling of, like, when you're a very shy person, there's a feeling of, like, the only way you can actually sort of exist is to do the scariest, bravest thing somehow. Mm. Like you literally, it's almost like you just have to sort of force yourself to jump off a cliff or you wouldn't do anything.
Robert De Niro, his son told me the same thing about him.
Oh, really?
Really? I knew I had a lot
you
in common with
his
Robert
De Niro. Son in the Bernie Madoff TV
yeah,
show.
But to get that job, I had to go to meet him on a yacht off the coast of Corsica.
That's dreadful.
And I ended up staying for 3 days. And in that time, there was, you know, a lot of extreme sports that were happening, which like was a kind of, I guess, a sort of test of my manhood or something. And we found ourselves like riding jet skis at top speed, sort of, you know, side by side, you know. And then like the yacht had like a, it actually wasn't a yacht, it was an Arctic icebreaker that had been converted to a luxury boat. The front of it was like 50 feet off the sea, you know, a big sharp sort of thing that would cut through. And he said, you know, my sons and I are going to jump off the bow of the boat.
Don't stint on the
Denier. And
I'm sensing you know, you're holding back.
I'm going to keep holding back. Yeah. But, you know, he said, want to come? And I said, okay, you know, so up we went. And he just swan dived.
No. Robert De Niro?
Off the
he's
like.
An elderly gentleman.
Yes,
now.
He was, well, when this was the, I've worked with him 3 times now. This is the first time. And he was already in his 70s. And off he went, like,
oh
you know, like it went in and there was like no splash, nothing. And then his like 12-year-old kid went like, ah, you know, Geronimo or whatever. And like off he went, you know, it was really high. And I like held my groin, you know, and pointed my toes. Anyway, it was like a whole weekend of this kind of thing where he was just like, you know, fearless.
God.
And we were flying back and his son jumped on the plane with us on the way back. And I was talking to his son and I was saying, I mean, it was this conversation, you know, is your dad like totally unafraid of anything? Like, is that just it? Like, he just doesn't have that. It's like that guy, Alex Honnold, who climbed El Cap or whatever.
No,
he's missing an amygdala thing or whatever.
He
doesn't have it. He's not scared. And the son said, no. He gets scared. And I was like, really? You know? And he said, yeah. But he just says, gotta do it. Gotta do it.
Because, and your point, Em, is because you're scared, the only way to break out of that fear and inertia is to do the things you're scared of.
Well, to even go, like, to do a really extreme version of the thing that you're scared of.
Right.
Somehow, I don't know why I got that logic, but I just discovered, I don't know why, as a very shy person, I signed up for this English speaking union speech competition, but I did. And it wasn't even about the speech itself, because my dad wrote the speech.
No, I should say, for anybody who doesn't know, of course, this is a very important part of this conversation. Emily's dad was the great Sir John Mortimer, who was a famous barrister, defended the Sex Pistols, but also the author of Rumpole of the Bailey and tons of novels and plays and screenplays. He was the guy who wrote the script for the TV version, the famous TV version of Brideshead Revisited. And all round brilliant man, and particularly a man of the theatre.
Yes, he was. Yes, he loved the theatre.
Sorry for the interpolation.
Yes,
carry
no, thank
so your
you.
Your dad wrote your speech.
My dad wrote my speech, but it was about anarchy. And it was really cool. It was a great speech. He's a great writer and everything. But so, I mean, we kind of wrote it together, but basically he wrote it. It was all about Prince Lev Kropotkin and his pelicans. The pelicans being the proof that we should all live in a communist, anarchist sort of society, because he was a great natural scientist and he'd studied pelicans, and apparently blind pelicans get fed by seeing pelicans, which was his proof that sort of mutual aid is innate in all of us and that we are built to look after each other.
Pelicans
that,
also feed their young with the blood of their breasts.
I did know that.
Scratch their own breasts with their bills, sharp bills, and feed, which is why it's a symbol of Christ.
Isn't it my pelican daughters in King Lear?
Podcast,
aren't there pelican daughters in King Lear? But
there
that
are
was
pelican
quite,
daughters.
But I don't know
yes.
whether that's... They're not very nice, the daughters in King
no,
Lear, so
but
it, doesn't
maybe
make it doesn't add up. Yeah, anyway, he wrote this very good speech. So it wasn't that I was nervous about my speech. It was just... I can just remember walking to the podium with this speech in my hand, just thinking, I am actually literally going to die. Like, there is no way I'm going to get to that podium without dying. Like, I'm so scared. I could almost see my heart just sort of like leaping out of my chest. And I just remember putting my speech down on the thing and just thinking, holy shit, this is just the worst. Like, and then I just started saying it. And I don't know what happened, but something happened. It wasn't like it was amazing, but it was kind of cool. Like, it was almost like this sort of hand took mine or something. That sounds a bit sort of pretentious, but it did feel like that. It felt sort of, oh, it's okay. And in that moment, I don't know why, but I just felt okay. And then I enjoyed it and it went quite well. And it was just like I don't know whether it was just like, it's the kind of, the anticipation was so horrifying. It's like banging your head against a brick wall. It's nice when it's over. And just the fact that it was actually happening and there was no going back made it bearable, or it was partly just communicating something to people and feeling like in real life, it was very hard to talk to people without feeling like an idiot. But in that circumstance, for some reason, I was saying something I cared about and I meant to people, and I felt like I could just say it and they were hearing it, and it was cool and it felt so nice just to be able to communicate without feeling like an idiot, which is what I spend most of my life
it's feeling. Also, for those of us who want to communicate or feel a need to communicate for whatever reason, it's also a captive situation. It's slightly a hostage situation,
yes,
isn't it?
Yes.
Did that give you the sense that, oh, this is plays for me?
Yeah, I guess so. That I wanted to.
Did you have an exciting time doing separate tables?
Oh, well, then I had my first kiss on stage, which was a disaster.
We're back to the beginning.
Yes.
It was a disaster.
It was a disaster, yes. It was, well, the play itself was quite good, but I was at St. Paul's School for Girls.
We've moved on from Kensington.
From Kensington High School to Girls, I went to St. Paul's School for Girls. And I did plays then, having discovered that I liked doing my English Speaking Union thing. I signed up for the school play, and the school play was with boys who were at the boys' St. Paul's School for Boys. Oh. And I'd never really met a boy. And being very shy, as I said, I had no sort of social interaction with anyone, but particularly boys. And so it was my first sort of encounter with boys aged about 15. And I had to kiss a boy from the boys' school in the play. And it was my first, I had kissed my cousin in a swimming pool once, but that was my only other interaction with a boy. And it was the first night of this play, and it was all so exciting and everything. And I was playing this ex-model in Separate Table, the Terence Rattigan play. And we're all at some sort of hotel in Bournemouth or something. Where is it?
I don't remember.
Anyway, Seaside Hotel, and I have to kiss this major or something. And he was quite handsome, and he was from the boys' school. I can't remember his name, but it will come to me. And I had lots of red lipstick on because I was playing an ex-model, and I thought that's what models would do. And a part of the sort of setup was that I had to kiss him, and then they didn't have really a set, so they didn't have the mirror that I was meant to look in on the stage. It wasn't a physical thing, but I was meant to look in the audience and sort of adjust myself, having kissed him.
Using the audience as a mirror.
Using the audience as a mirror. But the drawback was I couldn't see myself. So anyway, there wasn't a mirror. It was the audience. And I kissed him. And of course, we hadn't actually kissed each other in the rehearsal because it was too embarrassing. But we finally, and it was like the first proper kiss of my life. And I was like, and it was just this mad sort of teenage smooch. And all the red lipstick went all over my face, but I had no idea. And then I went to sort of like do my, to get myself together in the mirror, and everybody, like all these school children just pissing, and their parents just pissing themselves laughing. And I didn't have any idea why until I went off the stage minutes later, like a whole scene later.
Well, this is the perfect encapsulation of your career thereafter. The mixture of sort of glamour and comedy, where glamour meets comedy coming around the other side, sort of unwittingly, is your absolute, no one does it better. I think you added layers to that character with that. Not knowing that you had lipstick all over your face.
Really,
Sandra, was there a part that you did in your formative years that made you think, oh, wait, beyond the furries? Was there a part that made you think, this is for me? Did you know from quite early on?
Yeah, I mean, I wanted to be an actor since I was really, really little.
Why do you think?
I don't know. I can't explain it.
That's great for this podcast. But I respect it.
Then I was here at the British American Drama Academy at Oxford, over a summer, which was like a summer theater program that was coordinated between Yale and Oxford. I don't know how it worked exactly. It was some independent thing. And they got like great English thespians to come and give us master classes and stuff. Mm. And so there was all kinds of, Timothy West, yep. Pernella Scales.
Derek Jacobi, didn't you say?
Derek that? Jacobi, yeah. Your co-star in Medea, Fiona Shaw. Mm. But the really amazing teacher there was a guy who had run the Yale Drama School for a while, who, like Sanford Meisner, had a tracheotomy and had a voice box thing where, it made him talk like this and everything was like extremely mechanical, but he would talk about very emotional things. And so he would talk about Chekhov. I mean, his whole course was designed around scene study with Chekhov. And his whole thing, which I'm sure you've heard in various different ways, was what is called playing in action. And the way he defined it was, how do you want to make the other person feel? And the beauty of it was that it took all of the focus off of yourself and turned it into something active, so that all your attention and energy was going into trying to affect somebody else on the stage with you. And so it took away your self-consciousness. I mean, it was a beautiful thing. And he taught it through these Chekhov scenes. And I remember him sort of saying, like, he was teaching some scene from The Three Sisters, and I was playing Vershinin, or, this is the last time you will ever see Masha. How does that make you feel? And a tear in his eye and everything. I mean, it was incredible. But he fell in love with my co-star, my scene partner. And
these were different times.
Apparently, he started inviting her over to his... sorry, this is awful. But he started inviting her over to his rooms. And he brought my scene partner back to his rooms at Oxford. And she told me that he had like a bunch of different voice box things that had different volumes, and that like when he wanted to get intimate, he would like reach for the quiet one and like get,
suddenly get quiet.
You get the Barry White one out. This has really taken an extraordinary turn.
Anyway, this was another one of my like great inspirations. Amazing teacher.
But Em, speaking about Chekhov, didn't you have an amazing experience at Oxford in Russia, in Moscow?
Well, yes, I went to the Moscow Art Theatre.
You studied Russian.
I studied Russian
at Oxford.
Yes.
And you went to the famous Moscow Arts Theatre.
Yes.
And sort of studied acting there.
I mean, I did. I had been there on my gap year to Moscow, and I had befriended the woman that ran the Nimirovich Danchenko Museum, he was the unsung hero of the Moscow Arts Theatre, because it was set up by him and Chekhov and Stanislavski. Nimirovich Danchenko was the kind of very soulful, quieter one. Stanislavski was the sort of
flamboyant
one that irritated the hell out of Chekhov constantly, because he was always sort of talking about sort of, psychological realism and everything. And Chekhov kept saying, they're funny,
It's a comedy.
They're funny plays and everything. And Nimirovich Danchenko was the soulful one. And my friend worked in the Nimirovich Danchenko Theatre Museum. And so I had befriended her, and she was called Genrietta Nikolaevna, and she was really cool, and she smoked loads of cigarettes. And she got me on to a course at the Moscow Arts Theatre when I came back in my third year, and I studied there, but I didn't really learn anything. Well, I mean, I kind of did. I basically just got a big crush on my acting teacher and didn't concentrate at all on what I was meant to be learning. But I did do a play in Russian a scene in Russian from Lermontov's Masquerade.
On the Moscow Arts Theatre.
On the stage
famous...
of the Moscow Arts Theatre, yeah.
So,
and I saw the thing I remember the most is Oleg Yefremov was running the Moscow Arts Theatre at the time, who was this great sort of figure in the theatre there. And I saw a production of Uncle Vanya with him as Astrov and Smoktunovsky as Uncle Vanya, and Smoktunovsky's the guy that was Hamlet, you know, the white-haired Hamlet in the famous Russian film of it. And I saw him be about 3 years before he died, be Uncle Vanya. And I really can remember like that, like it was yesterday. He was amazing. So I can remember him blowing his cigar and batting the smoke away, you know, and I just stayed with me. I can really see it. But yeah, I didn't learn much because I just got this sort of fearful crush on this guy.
You're a student, that's what it's for.
And I can remember going, I finally got him back to my house. I had a sort of party with all the students. And he came back to my house and my flat. And he came and we all had dinner. And I was so excited he was there. And then I just got so drunk. And then he went out onto the balcony and took me out onto the balcony. And I suddenly started, I couldn't believe this was happening. And I suddenly started feeling really ill, but I couldn't leave because I was standing on the balcony with this guy I was so into. And I needed to be sick. And I just was quietly sick into my hand as he sort of like, he was sort of talking about the moon and, you know, but he was so into what he was saying. He didn't notice I was standing behind him.
Quietly.
Vomiting.
And vomiting.
Yeah, but I had to sort of back away.
Wow.
And it never really, you know, nothing came.
I can't believe that.
If only she'd been paired with my acting teacher.
No, God.
And the point is, I suppose, despite this sort of, you know, coming from theatre royalty, your dad's immense involvement, you must have had, he worked with everybody, Olivier, Gil Goodwin, his productions, and you must have had an immense exposure to the life of the theatre. It must have seemed, I suppose, both glamorous and kind of ordinary at the same time. That was just the landscape of your life. That's a question.
Oh,
I mean, it was an upward inflection. I was on my way somewhere else, but maybe I should.
I guess it was very much around me, but I think it's weird. Like I was not necessarily, I mean, I can remember very clearly Laurence Olivier. They did, my dad wrote a play called A Voyage Around My Father. And it was initially Rex Harrison and then Alec Guinness and then Laurence Olivier was in with Alan Bates was in the film of it, and they filmed it in our house that my dad, because it was an autobiographical play, and they filmed it in the house that my dad grew up in, that my mum still lives in and everything. And I can remember Laurence Olivier as a little girl. I can remember one of my earliest memories is breaking into his trailer with my friend who lived down the road and eating all his lion bars and seeing this wig on a sort of stand and it was just so sort of mysterious and strange and smelt of sort of old men and makeup, and it was just sort of, and then I can remember seeing him in the garden. He was really quite old. It was one of the last things he did. And he couldn't remember any of his lines, but I mean, he's amazing. It's one of his great performances.
Has anybody here seen that performance of Olivier's in Voyage from My Father?
You can watch it on YouTube, actually.
I mean, it's just.
It's a really incredible performance, but he couldn't remember any of his lines. And so I can remember, like it was yesterday, saying they wrote the lines on big, huge idiot boards they sort of pinned up on the trees. And I can remember my dad saying that they said, when somebody came up and sort of nervously asked, you know, Sir Laurence Olivier when he was going to start speaking in the scene, and he said, "I shall speak as I approach the dialogue." But anyway, so I remember this magical thing happened where our house was completely transformed, our own house, and all the furniture was taken out, and much nicer sort of, to me, much sort of furniture that matched was put in it. And these actors acted out scenes in our garden and our house. And then they had a kind of wrap party, and you found sort of months afterwards, like plastic cups in the bushes. And I saw my mum dancing with the sort of props team sort of whirling around on this dance floor in the garden. And it all felt so magical and exciting. And actually, Laurence Olivier pretended to die. He was playing my father's father, and he pretended to die in the bed that my father's father had actually died in. So it was this kind of hall of mirrors thing. And my dad always acted out plays on the stairs. He was a lonely, quite shy little boy, actually, weirdly, you would never think it. And so he would act out plays on the stairs as a child. That's part of the play, and that's in the film. And I acted out plays on the stairs, and my sister and brothers and everything did too, who's here tonight. And so to see that was kind of amazing and exciting and strange, and to sort of, I don't know. So there was a feeling of like, oh, this is somehow part of my life and I understand it. But I wasn't that like enchanted by, I was much more lowbrow in my tastes. So I wanted to really be Torval and Dean. I was obsessed by ice dances, even though I was no good at ice dancing, but I just sort of wanted like feathers in my hair and sequins. And that was what I really wanted.
But you did start out having a stage career. And I think we should say at this point that unlike every single guest I've had on this podcast, who is by definition really into performing on stage, Em, you're kind of an apostate about it. You know, you have done it, of course, but really are not...
into it.
Into it. No, and really. I think it's actually fantastic to have the sort of recorded testimony of someone who's not, who finds it problematic and difficult and troubling.
Terrifying.
But you did start out, didn't you? And what was it that started to give you problems when you, after you left Oxford and became a professional actress and started doing stuff in big stages with amazing people, what happened that unbalanced you?
I think I was just probably quite unbalanced, and I was young, and so I was like sort of not getting enough sleep and drinking too much probably, and just, as I said, as you've heard, I was very kind of repressed as a child, so because I was so shy. So I did a lot of making up for lost time in terms of boys and sort of parties. And so I was kind of appearing on the stage basically with just a kind of extreme hangover and very fraught and sort of underslept at most times. So I think that just sort of terror was amplified by the fact that I was not in a sort of fit state to be doing it.
But maybe you were not in a fit state to be doing it because you were terrified. Too.
Yes, it is terrifying. I mean, I can still remember those moments of in the play that we did, like looking at that kind of red light that goes green on the, you know, backstage, and you're waiting in the wings, and you're just like, there's a light that tells you when you've got to go on, and it starts off red, and then at a certain point it goes green, and you just have to walk on, and it's like you're just looking at this red light, thinking, what the fuck am I doing this? Like, I could be doing anything else. Yes. I could just be sitting at home reading a book, like. This is like bungee jumping times a million. Like, I don't want to do... Everything in my body is telling me not to do it. And then the light fucking goes green and you're like, oh, God. And again, I get all sorts of sort of terrifying, intrusive thoughts where I think I'm going to shout things out.
You said to The Guardian, your greatest fear was shouting something inappropriate either in the audience of the theatre or on stage.
Yes. Dolly, my best friend Dolly, gets it too. She thinks she's going to shout the word mint.
Mint.
Which are out, but either in the audience or on stage. But I have worse things I can't even permit to, but I think I'm going to shout out, or I'm going to leap into the audience, or... It's just that thing of everybody's being so well behaved and like they paid good money to be there, but they're all sitting there and there's no, everybody's sort of so respectful and there's this sort of quiet sort of thing. And like, why is everybody not?
So your unconscious brain wants to
ruin it. Ruin it for everybody. And so that's going on all the time.
And that becomes a very powerful and difficult thing to deal with. So better to just sort of take yourself away from temptation.
Yes. And then I had a really bad experience where things went terribly wrong. I played the role of Portia in The Merchant of Venice in Scotland, and it was a debacle. And I haven't really recovered from that. Like, that was like, I don't know whether...
What happened?
So I fell in love with a guy playing Bassanio.
There is a little bit of a theme developing on both sides of the aisle here.
I got really distracted and I was just sort of like, I also was in Scotland and I sort of just was like, no one I know is going to come to this play. It's too far away for anyone. I don't know. I was just like, and I sort of felt like, it doesn't matter because I'm just far from home and I can just sort of like concentrate on whether trying to get this guy to be into me. And anyway, and I also felt like I know, I've studied this play a lot and I know it. And I've sort of got, my dad was all into The Merchant of Venice because it was all about, you know,
justice.
I don't know. I think I was extremely arrogant and also just completely distracted and young and idiotic. And I didn't prepare it enough. It was one of those things where it was literally the first night, the press night or whatever, when everybody's gathered. Mm. And it's like the one that has to really be good.
Right.
Where I suddenly was just like, I don't know what I'm doing and I haven't worked on this at all hard enough to be good. And I suddenly just got that awful thing where you forget the lines and your head is going, I can't remember the line. I'm not going to be able to remember the line. I've completely forgotten all of it. And then it does come, but it comes at the very last second.
The final nanosecond before you have to say it.
And yes, and I was just I went off stage in the interval and I had pretty much sort of bleeding palms from my fingernails. And I was just like, oh my God, this is awful. And I'm letting everybody down and most of all myself. And I was just so hate myself. Like, this is so bad. And anyway, so I thought I was going to give myself a pep talk, yes. Which I thought this is the only thing for it. I don't know. I just have to give myself a pep talk. So I looked in the mirror at the dressing room and I sat there just sort of looking at myself, just going, come on, you can do this. I mean, I knew I didn't know what I was doing, but I thought, just pretend, like, when you go back out, just do it with confidence. Like, just pretend you know what you're doing and something will happen. And just, like, stride on with confidence and don't let this kind of, you know, whatever upend you. Anyway, so I was like, okay, I've got this. And the first scene in the after the interval was me packing for Venice and ordering my ladies in waiting to come and pack because we had to leave for Venice. So I was like, okay, I'm just going to do this really confidently and then it will all fall into place. So I just sort of strode on saying to my ladies in waiting, you know, come to Venice or whatever. And I was so busy being confident that I completely forgot that this enormous fiberglass pillar denoting Belmont was flying in from the ceiling. And I just coincided with it completely. Like, my nose and the pillar just went boing. Oh, and I knocked myself out and broke my nose. And I was... prostate. I mean, I was lying, just my feet were poking out from beneath this pillar. Like, and they had the next
The Wicked Witch of the West.
Yes. It was like the Wicked Witch of the West.
Why are you pointing to me?
Because of Toto.
Oh, wow. Bring it back around.
Oh, my God.
Yes.
You were knocked out cold.
I was knocked out cold. And so then I went backstage and I can remember sitting on a chair and someone saying, can you go back on? And I was like, yes, I think so, maybe. And I went back on. And I got to the end of the play. Of course, people liked me much more after I'd been knocked out. I probably was a bit better after I'd been knocked out. Apparently, as I was doing The Quality of Mercy Is Not Strained or whatever, I got these two enormous black eyes. I mean, and it was a nightmare that was a tiny bit saved by me knocking myself out. But the nightmare continued. Like, it was like I never worked out how to do that part. And it was like Dead Man Walking for sort of 3 months. And the awful thing about that one was that it was the bar was in the theater that we would go to. And I was in disguise because apparently Portia's blonde, which I didn't realize until I did that play, but it says one line, says she's blonde. So I had a blonde wig. And so nobody recognized me in the bar. And I'd hear them just say horrible things about me. I can remember getting a drink from the bar and there was a man in a kilt saying, I thought Portia was meant to be charming. That girl was so irritating. Her voice was so irritating. Was like... Anyway, I haven't really recovered from that.
God, I'm not surprised.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
All right, that's the end of Act One of my live recorded chat with Emily Mortimer and Alessandra Nivola. Poor Emily. Flattened and then humiliated as Portia. And no wonder she's had a long time recovering from that. But please come back and join me for Act Two. It only gets better and better and better from here. If you want to hear what happened when Sarah Kane's legendary play Blasted was narrated live while the action was going on stage by Sir John Mortimer, Emily's father. What happened when John met Tom Cruise? The fallout from when Alessandra bit Helen Mirren's tattoo? How an elderly actor called in sick to the stage door? What Emily and Alessandro think about the freedom these days to be transgressive on stage and in the rehearsal room? What sharing a dressing room with Bradley Cooper is like? And how acting on stage is like scuba diving? You're going to want to hear the rest of this chat. Please come back and join me for Act 2. Stage, stage, stage door.